Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solotopia, Solotopia, Solotopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solotopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Yes, we are. We're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world. This is Harvey Wasserman with the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We're back for another scintillating hour of talk about what's happening in the world of climate change, nuclear power, which is fast leaving us, and renewable energy. We have two great guests today, Scott Sklar and Tim from Nuclear Information Resource Service. How are you guys? You with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, hi, Harvey. Thanks for having me.
Okay, which one of you is bald?
Sklar here, totally bald and bearded.
Okay, Scott, bald and bearded from the solar energy. Scott, you've been with solar energy for so long, and you have so many credentials. Why don't you tell us a bit about yourself, and then Tim, you as well. You have just taken over as ED, executive director of. I guess ED has a different. People start to stop using ED, I guess, because of all the ads for Viagra and all that stuff, but. Scott, tell us who you are, and we're going to talk today.
I've been in the clean energy field for 40 years, and for 15 of those years, ran the Solar Energy Industries Association. For 3 years, worked for the National Environmental Community in advocating for clean energy during President Reagan years, and for the last 14 years, run a company that blends renewable energy all over the world. And I am steering committee chair of the Sustainable Energy Coalition here in Washington, D.C., composed of the renewable energy and efficiency trade groups and advocacy groups, of which the Nuclear Information Research Service is a member. And finally, I'm an adjunct professor at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C., teaching two unique interdisciplinary courses on sustainable energy. Where I bring in law students and business students and engineering students and the science part of the arts and science students to talk about energy from a sustainability point of view.
Whoa, that's good stuff, Scott. And you work with my nephew, Amit Ronen, who is also just taken a chair. Is it at George Washington or Georgetown?
Oh, it's George Washington, and it's the Solar Institute, which was set up with funds from Ted Turner to look at make solar energy research and analysis a little more practical and reachable by the policymakers in this town, because the scientists somehow are in their own world, and so this is also an interdisciplinary function that Amit, who worked for Senator Cantwell for many years as her energy aide, has just taken over.
Very good, very good. And Tim, introduce yourself, please.
Sure. So, yeah, my name is Tim Judson. I'm the new executive director at the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. I just started, before starting with NIRS last fall, I was actually a grassroots activist based in New York and New England, a long time with the Citizens Awareness Network, and was part of the campaign that shutting down the Vermont Yankee reactor. And someone from Syracuse and New York City have, you know, worked for, you know, most of the last 16 years on issues related to, to the reactors like Indian Point and Nine Mile Point and Fitzpatrick in New York State. And, through that have really been, monitoring a lot of what's been going on in the industry, in particular, you know, the major corporations like Entergy and Exelon, which are, you know, really in trouble and in danger of, actually, it's not a danger that they may have to shut down a lot of their reactors soon, but there's a lot of serious safety issues related to the fact that, that they're in financial trouble.
Well, it'd be a wonderful thing if they shut down those reactors, and it would certainly ease their financial troubles in the long term. But I want to congratulate you on your great work at Vermont Yankee. It will be shutting, we hope, we assume, at the end of this year, and we hope it will be joined by many, many other reactors soon to shut down, although there is a conference coming up, I guess, in D.C. To talk about nuclear power and whether or not these reactors should shut based on climate. Can you, Scott, can you comment on that conference upcoming a little bit?
Which conference?
Is this the American Progress Conference? The one with they're going to be talking about atomic energy and its alleged impact on,
yeah,
on
Harvey,
global warming. Tim, you know about that one?
It's a briefing being put on, by folks at Pew, who are part of this Climate Change and Energy Solutions group that they set up, who are releasing a brief talking about the need to basically prop up the American nuclear power industry in order to meet our climate goals.
Yeah, and Exelon, from whence comes Barack Obama, has put out kind of a scare notice that they're going to start shutting reactors unless they get mega handouts. Is that accurate?
Well, actually, it's not Exelon. Exelon's been forced to admit that. Wall Street has been putting out analyses. A number of investment firms have been putting out analyses over the last year, actually, calling attention to this fact. In analyst reports, at least a dozen reactors have been named as a danger of closure just because of the economic troubles the industry is facing with low energy prices. And Exelon has basically, and Entergy have basically taken this opportunity to try to drum up a sense of crisis around the fact that they're going to have to start shutting reactors to try to win new subsidies for their old nukes, and also to sort of heighten their attacks on renewables, which they see as increasingly the biggest threat to nuclear power.
Well, we hope it is, for God's sakes, and we hope that all these reactors shut down as rapidly as possible. I do want to mention before we lose track of it that this week, and I've posted this at the website I edit, nukefree.org, nukefree.org, that the two reactors proposed for Temelin in Czechoslovakia, or the Czech Republic, actually, are not going to proceed. And this is something Michael Marriott at the Nuclear Information Resource Service has worked on for many, I would say decades, actually, and it's a cause for rejoicing.
Yeah, indeed it is. And, after, I think, over a decade of activists in Eastern Europe and across the world, lobbying against that reactor, the government a couple weeks ago decided that it wasn't going to give any more financial support to the project. And, as soon as that, infinite well of financial support dried up, the utility has decided that it's not going to continue with the project. It's great news.
Yes, and that says something about the state of the nuclear industry worldwide as well, of course, as in Europe. I want to mention one other thing before we jump in on specific on renewables, that it's become clear now that the one good thing, if anything could come from a world-scale, global-scale nuclear disaster like Fukushima, the one good thing that's becoming clear is that of the 48 reactors that remain shut in Japan, and where the new essentially fascist regime, the Abe regime, is trying to get them reopened, it's pretty clear that at least 30 of those 48 are highly unlikely to ever reopen at all. They are too old, too expensive, and so it looks like, obviously there's going to be a big fight over reopening some of them. But at least 30 of them appear to be beyond the reach of those who would reopen them. I'm sure both of you have seen those stories.
Yeah, absolutely, Harvey. And we're really hopeful that they're going to at least maintain a modicum of of safety standards that would prevent most of those reactors from reopening. But I think, you know, really, you know, the fact that the Abe regime is, you know, is still trying to reopen any of them is a tremendous diversion of resources and, you know, both financial and, you know, and human and corporate from dealing with the situation at Fukushima. You know, the billions of dollars and, you know, and regulatory attention that they're giving to trying to restart these other reactors really needs to be put on Fukushima and getting that situation under control. You know, it's a tremendous tragedy that they're wading through and muddling through this situation that way.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, now let's move on to the biggest news of the week for those of us who are trying to sustain a planet to live on, which is the IPCC Intergovernmental Policy Commission on Climate Change and panel on climate change. And Scott, the panel has made it clear that global warming or climate change, I really hate the term global warming. I mean, it clearly the planet is warming up. But, you know, you get a cold winter, you get a cold stretch like now, and all the idiots like Rush Bimbo come out of the closet. But it's clear that the IPCC has delivered a ringing endorsement of renewable energy to solve the global climate crisis. Scott, as one of the elders of the solar industry, how do you read this report?
Well, just to recap, it's the fifth United Nations panel assessment on climate change issued, and it had 235 climate scientist authors and 31 modeling teams from around the world. And they've had 1,200 different scenarios, computer modeled, from the best to worst, to sort of lay out this report. And basically, it said that if we're going to limit 2 degrees Celsius temperatures, we're going to have to lower greenhouse gas emissions somewhere between 40% to 70% compared to what we put out in 2010, and that would keep this warming increase, so we wouldn't have as horrible a set of climate uncertainty that we have now. So that's basically what they said, and they said you had to do it now, and you really have to start dropping out fossil fuel. And by the way, they said the cost of bringing renewables in, this is the key thing that is so astounding of the report, would be that it would only cost the world about half of 1% of their GDP. So meaning it's a very, very small amount. Inflation cost the world more than that many times. So
that's gross domestic product is GDP.
Of the world.
And that's for all the nations of the
right.
world.
Right. So this is a really, what this is really saying here is, you know, we don't have, you know, it's really 0.5%, actually it's 0.06% impact on economic growth rates. This is the way to go, and they basically said these renewables in particular are mature enough and are scaling up fast enough to do it, but, you know, the governments of the world really have to, divest $30 billion a year from fossil fuel over the decade and so to drive it in the direction of accelerating and scaling up renewables. So that's the good news here, and these are the global scientists from around the world. No one's pitching it. There was a story today in some of the major press that the industrialized countries, the United States in particular, India and China, tempered down some of these recommendations publicly. So they were actually a little more dire before they were to be released. But it's good enough. It lays out the message we need to be seeing.
Tim, do you want to chime in on that?
Sure. Well, I think that, you know, the great news in what Scott just said about, you know, the IPCC's estimate of what the cost of switching to renewables would be, is that, you know, we can, you know, we can essentially, you know, create the future that we want in terms of energy, add a net savings in terms of cost. But the other side to that is that renewable energy solutions and energy efficiency solutions create way, 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 way more jobs than our current energy system provides. And so I think there's a way in which we can envision this transition to a sustainable energy economy worldwide is something that really sort of drives, you know, both economic and social justice progress as well. And you know, and I think at the same time, what we're seeing on the flip side of this, which is, you know, this transition that we're starting to edge into, is that, you know, the way in which the cost of renewables is falling is, you know, one of the leading factors that's putting economic pressure on nuclear power. And leading to the situation that we're in right now, where, you know, potentially in the next few years, dozens of reactors across the U.S. could close. And, you know, and what that brings about is the possibility that we could accelerate ourselves into a sustainable energy transition that could also be a real economic driver in, you know, solving the long-term problems with unemployment and the decline of the middle class that we've seen in the U.S. And that's a very exciting potential future that we've got the opportunity to move into very aggressively.
Well, let me ask you both, in this, and it's very important that we underscore that this is the panel on climate change. This is the most prestigious, the most powerful, the best funded, and the most authoritative group to pronounce on climate change. Is that correct? Or am I blowing smoke here?
Well, yeah, I mean, they, you know, I see all these reports, and of course the Fox News commentators that say, you know, these guys don't know what they're talking about, and then they'll find some, you know, structural engineer who has an opinion on it. And, you know, and so if you really look at the deniability reports, they have people with some degrees after the name, but they're not climate scientists. These are the world's climate scientists. And, you know, there was an amazing report done on climate change looking at disagreements among climate scientists, and of the 600 reviewed reports that were issued in the last decade, only one of the 600 disagreed that the climate is changing and that human action is the major driver of that change. So this is authoritative, but goes along with the other four authoritative studies, as well as many other non-international studies that have backed this up.
Now, just for the record, what are the other four? Oh, you mean the previous four from the IPCC?
Studies, yes.
So this is the fifth report from the IPCC. It came out in three sections, basically. All three sections have essentially underscored the need to cut fossil fuel emissions. And they have given us, you know, basically 15 years to do it, which is more than I thought we would hear from them. But they it's somewhat of a more relaxed view of how much time we have to change than many people have thought about. But nonetheless,
it's a big world. It's a big world. And I'd like to point out something, and I want this is very important for your listeners to understand, is the reason a good portion of the Washington political system, at least half of it, and I'd say a good portion of the news media is nervous about this, is there is a fundamental disbelief that the alternative energy sources could fill the gap. And what I teach in my courses at George Washington University is I give my students a list of 27 studies all done in the last few years, which taken individually or in aggregate show that with technologies, plural, we have today in high-value energy efficiency and renewable energy, we can meet almost all or all of the U.S. or world's energy needs sustainably. There is no such compendium of studies that shows you can do that with fossil fuel or nuclear power. So, you know, part of it is to make people understand that the options are real, that these are not just, you know, a bunch of kids from Venice Beach, you know, putting up a solar panel, that these are mass, large manufacturing plants making wind turbines, making photovoltaics, solar electric panels, solar water heating, concentrated solar, marine energy, tidal and wave and free flow hydro, and geothermal and energy efficiency technologies like combined heat and power, and LED lights, and of course, biogas from cattle manure and potentially human sewage. So we have a lot of options that are out there that are actually economic, and the idea is to rev them up and scale them some more.
Very good. That's Scott Sklar from the solar industry, also Tim Judson from the Nuclear Information Resource Service. We will take a break in about 7 minutes. I want to emphasize one thing real quickly. Scott, you mentioned that Fox News, and we use that term advisedly, has been critical of this idea of global warming. We want to remember when we evaluate Fox News that they did come out and with the opinion that one of the reasons that Germany has gone to green energy faster than the United States is because there's more sunlight in Germany. I want to make sure that that has been clearly put down on the record here once again. Well, Scott and Tim, in this report, or these three reports that have come the fifth time around from the IPCC, what are the critical drawbacks that have been listed about renewable energy in these reports, if any?
The only thing I could find, and maybe, Tim, you read it differently, but the only thing I could find was the requirement that the global governments have to just get their act together. Now, clearly, they highlighted some leaders in renewable energy. And by the way, the United States is one of the leaders. As is China, as is a strong handful of the European countries, Great Britain and Germany and Spain, and Japan, and Brazil and Costa Rica. So, I mean, there's quite a few countries that are stepping up, but that it has to be faster and larger. And they basically said you have to stop subsidizing fossil fuels, which is about at the tune of $800 billion globally, and several studies have been on that. And so, you know, that we have to stop subsidizing the dirtier stuff and the more dangerous stuff and help, not forever, the technologies get scale and then stop subsidizing them as well. And I do want to point out for this show, I use this all the time, that in February 2011, the Union of Concerned Scientists looked at the U.S. subsidy of nuclear power, and they found more than 30 subsidies have supported every stage of the nuclear fuel cycle, from uranium mining to long-term waste storage, which added together subsidizes from 70 to 120% of the investment in a nuclear power plant. So talk about taxpayers subsidizing that stuff, too.
Well, did the IPCC report, and maybe, Tim, you noticed, give a figure of an estimate of the global subsidies given to nuclear power right now?
Not that I've read, Harvey, but it could have just been in a piece of the report that I haven't seen yet. You know, I think that it's pretty much indisputable that the nuclear eats up a tremendous amount of the energy dollars in countries that promote it. And in fact, I think as you see, you know, clearly with the fact that you know, at this point, India and China are the only, you know, are you know, where the lion's share of nuclear development is, that this is all happening on the backs of taxpayers. Where nuclear corporations are being forced to do things even closer to being on the market, so to speak, like the U.S., it's just not happening. Nuclear, and it's only happening in the U.S. to the extent that, state utility commissions have signed a blank check for ratepayers to be charged for the cost of building reactors, and that the U.S. government, the Congress, has signed the taxpayers up to provide, essentially guaranteed loans to the handful of nuclear projects that are being built right now. Wall Street is extremely clear, with the nuclear industry that even with the kind of subsidies that the U.S. government is offering, any company that decides to undertake building a new nuclear reactor is really in danger of being downgraded, nearly to junk bond status.
Okay, we're talking with Tim Judson of the Nuclear Information Resource Service. Tim, what is your website for people to go to?
Sure, it's www.nirs.org.
And Scott Sklar, what's your best website right now?
My company website, www.thestella.com.
Okay, and basically we're talking about the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. This report has made headlines worldwide about the future of our atmosphere and the question of global warming, which seems to be no longer much of a question at all. And when we come back, we take a short break here. Here, Dana Lyons sing the Solartopia Rocky Top version. When we come back, I want to talk. There was a listing in the IPCC report, and I have posted a summary at nukefree.org of the drawbacks that it listed on nuclear power. And I noticed a deafening silence from the tiny little handful of alleged climate scientists. Well, some of them clearly are climate scientists who are advocating nuclear power as a somehow a solution to climate change. And I really want to hunker down and look at those things that the IPCC said about nukes and to evaluate the realities of nuclear power as a so-called solution. We're here at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show with Scott Sklar and Tim Judson. We're going to take a short break. Dana Lyons is going to sing us the Rocky Top version of the Solartopia song. We'll be back about 3 minutes.
Pipelines, mega dams, Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan, oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam, road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia, it's time to get a better plan. Solartopia is home sweet home.
Yes, indeed. Lots of forests for the bears. That's my good buddy Dana Lyons singing us the Rocky Top version of the Solartopia song. We love Dana, and we go to his Cows with Guns website, Cows with Guns, over 2 million hits on his wonderful video of him singing Cows with Guns. We're here with Scott Sklar of the solar industry and Tim Judson of the Nuclear Information Resource Service talking about renewables and especially about the ringing endorsement of the new climate change panel, the latest intergovernmental panel on climate change, which has given us the big warning here on climate change and the need to go green. And if I'm not mistaken, this is a very, very powerful endorsement of renewable energy from one of the world's, if not the world's most authoritative source. Scott, would you agree with that assessment?
Absolutely. This is frankly the first time the IPCC has come out in context of climate in a major study so bullish on renewables. And frankly, part of that is because half the new power in the world last year came from renewables. So it was, the four reports ago, that wasn't the case. So the rise of renewables and, frankly, high-value energy efficiency has attracted hundreds of billions of dollars in global investment, and that's why this is happening, and about $1 trillion of investment by the world's governments per year. So this is a big change in the status of renewables globally, and now the scientific community is saying, finally, that, yeah, this portfolio, this clean, safe portfolio can do the job.
Now, did your organization put out a press release on this, a media advisory on this, that people can find? Have you posted anything on your website in response yet to the IPCC report?
I have not, but there are several groups who have, including the Union of Concerned Scientists, the Environmental and Energy Study Institute, both Washington-based nonprofits, as well as World Watch, which is the environmental think tank with a specialty on renewable energy.
Okay. And Tim Judson at NEARS, have you put out anything that people can see on this, or do you want to guide people towards statements that have been put out in response to this report?
Yeah, I would say, Harvey, that the resources that Scott just mentioned are really some of the best ones to go to at this point. And, like I said, before, I mean, NEARS isn't your global expert on climate change. We really, sort of focus on, nuclear power and as part of that, the question of, how we need to phase out nuclear power, to address climate change. But I think that, for analysis on the IPCC report, the organizations, as Scott mentioned, are really the best ones to go to at this point.
Okay, now, the climate report did mention nuclear power as a potential mitigant, let's put it that way, the lack of a better word, for carbon emissions. But it also listed a number of drawbacks to nuclear power. Do you have that in front of you? And can you? Because I remember seeing it. I'm looking for it now. I can't quite find it. The list of it was in the New York Times, actually. Oh, I've got the New York Times story. It listed a number of problems with nuclear power, and had no parallel listing for renewables. Do either of you have that?
Yeah, but let's talk about the one they highlighted, and also a great study analysis done by a research fellow at the National University of Singapore, and looking at the whole carbon cycle of nuclear power. But but before we get into the carbon cycle of nuclear power, even in the best circumstance, it's going to take you 10 years to construct a plant at $3 billion per 1,000 megawatt plant. Now, $3 billion is very conservative, okay?
Well, that's really optimistic, Scott. Right. I mean, I haven't seen a $3 billion investment for a nuke in a long time.
At $3 billion or $4 billion or $6 billion, but at a huge amount of money at once. And, by the way, that doesn't count dealing with the transmission lines and everything to take that power, and a 10-year lead time in construction, that just won't do what the IPCC is doing, which means we've got to start now. And frankly, when you look at the Sovacol study I talked about, even in the fuel cycle, nuclear's better than coal, but at the same time, You know, you look at wind is so much better than nuclear. It's unbelievable. And so the real issue is, if you want the lowest carbon technologies first, being most economic, you know, offshore wind has 6 times less carbon than a nuclear power plant. So why wouldn't you want, you know, by the way, sorry, that's onshore wind, is 6 times less carbon than a nuclear power plant. Why, you can do it within 18 months for less cost and be 6 times less carbon. So solar photovoltaics, the entire fuel cycle, is 2 times less carbon than a nuclear power plant. And you can do those in less than 6 months in megawatt sizes. So the point being here, if you want to do it fast and you want to be more geographically dispersed, solar and wind and geothermal and the marine and water technologies and the biogases can surely do it without question. Faster, cheaper, and less carbon.
What do you got to say to that, Tim? Tim Judson of NERS?
Yeah, you know, I think we're already seeing the impact of this across the country in the U.S. I think it's, you know, I think as Scott alluded to earlier, you know, we have a lot of education to do among the mainstream media and policymakers in the U.S., but you know, I think the reality on the ground is that this is exactly how it's playing out. I mean, for instance, in upstate New York, where I'm from, you know, we've been waiting, you know, almost, you know, 13 years now for a mythical, you know, fifth nuclear plant to be built on Lake Ontario on our side of the lake. You know, whereas, you know, in a year and a half, you know, they put up 300 megawatts of wind, you know, just east of there, in the Tug Hill Plateau. And, you know, so, you know, we got, after 13 years, we've got zero additional nuclear capacity, which was going to cost us, you know, $15 to $16 billion to build one nuclear reactor. And, you know, in a tenth of that time, we actually put up 300 megawatts of wind. You know, I think if, you know, dollar for dollar, you know, day for day, hour for hour, you know, the energy future is, you know, if we're going to get serious about meeting our climate change goals, is really about renewables. And I think the flip side of this is that, you know, is that nuclear is actually going to get in the way, you know, if you know, if policymakers, you know, sort of persist in, you know, in this notion that nuclear needs to be part of the sustainable energy solution, has to be part of the climate change or, you know, climate mitigation strategy. You know, nuclear is, you know, the problem with nuclear is that it's, you know, it's what they call baseload energy. And it, you know, reactors are built to run 100% out, you know, full power all the time, 24/7. And you know, the reality of the sustainable energy future is going to be, you know, flexible, responsive energy systems that where we can adjust to actually meet our needs. And nuclear is going to get in the way of that, and it doesn't work well, you know, with wind and solar and energy storage and hydro and the mix of sustainable solutions that we're really going to be, you know, sort of, you know, rebuilding our energy system to focus on.
Okay. I can't do this without throwing in a dash of reality here. I'm looking on my computer screen at an article in the Mail Online from Great Britain. And here is the headline about the IPCC report. Fracking can help slow global warming, admit UN scientists, and so can nuclear power. Now, and here's the headline. Here's the lead of the story here. Climate scientists have backed Britain's shale gas revolution, saying it could help slow global warming. The world's leading experts on climate change say fracking will cut greenhouse gas emissions and should be made central to the country's energy production. It will help the UK move away from dirty coal and contribute to saving the environment, according to a report by the influential Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Now that you are coming down off the ceiling, what the hell is this about?
Well, you know, what gets complicated in the greenhouse gas debate is if you're just looking at the benchmark of coal in terms of carbon emitted per kilowatt or megawatt, almost anything is better. So therefore, it allows, whether you're for fracking or burning oil, for that matter, to say you're cleaner. But the issue is that's really not what the IPCC was talking about. The IPCC was talking about fossil fuels, and that means coal, petroleum, and natural gas. And clearly, you know, I also believe that, you know, everything doesn't have to be purist overnight, and therefore there is a role for natural gas in a future economy, but you want to do it thoughtfully and carefully. But the fact of the matter is the IPCC was talking about all fossil fuels, and so, but groups within the fossil community who have lower emissions than coal imply that they then are a cleaner trend, and the report promotes them because the quote would fall under the energy efficiency rubric. So, but I think for this radio discussion, and really what the IPCC report was trying to say is we need to really move to start phasing out, as a family of nations, fossil fuels and do it as fast as practical, and it can be done economically, and we need to move in that direction, period. And that's the deal.
Well, here's another line from this story, although this is actually good news for anybody in the solar business. The scientists, this is quoting from the Daily Mail here, or the Mail Online from Great Britain. The scientists say, I'm referring to the IPCC, that wind, solar, and hydroelectric power need to triple or even quadruple in scale over the next 35 years if global warming is to be safely controlled. Now, that's doable, I would assume. Scott, you're in the business, yeah?
Yeah. No question about it. You know, now that we have scaled up manufacturing plants, and, you know, in this past year, we put up 1.3 gigawatts of concentrated solar power in the Southwest, which is, night and day solar. So we have now can do baseload solar as well. And, you know, 1.3 gigawatts is, you know, more than a nuclear power plant. And, you know, we're putting in wind at the gigawatt levels and photovoltaics at the gigawatt levels. And there's no reason we can't, at the gigawatt levels, put in tidal and wave and geothermal.
So now I have written, and maybe you can jump down my throat on this one, but that actually the legalization of marijuana is helping to free up the production of hemp, industrial hemp, which were the favorite crops of both George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. And have you looked into the biofuel possibilities of hemp, Tim or Scott?
I've co-authored a book called The Forbidden Fuel, released by University of Nebraska Press for its second printing, with two esteemed journalists, Bill Kovarik and Hal Burton. And, yeah, so I know a lot about both biofuels and bioelectricity and bioproducts. And first of all, I want to point out to people that we waste a lot. And so, you know, human sewage and animal manures are affecting our water quality and our health. And so to be able to reutilize these wastes for bioproducts, which are energy and fertilizers and building materials, is very important, then allow them to be in shallow pools like we do for the pig industries, for example.
Well, let's switch. We've only got 12 minutes left. I mean, this is flying by really quickly. I do want to throw in one thing, but since you two guys are experts and you're big, and you understand what's going on here, and maybe I missed it, did the IPCC mention at all, in terms of global warming, the industrial production of meat?
They talked about that one of the biggest emitters in agriculture are livestock. So they didn't talk about poultry, but they did talk about livestock. And the way it is raised in industrialized nations, moving away from being grass-fed, which would have a much, by the way, a much smaller carbon footprint, is the big issue. The way we raise animals is very carbon intensive. And by the way, the reason the digestive systems of cows put out more carbon methane, which is a more potent greenhouse gas, is because we moved them off of grasses. And it's not their natural diet. So by putting them back on grasses and getting rid of these fertilizers and stop raising grain for cattle, and other livestock around the world would have immense implications on our climate.
Yeah, that's really, you don't have to advocate, and this is important to understand, I think, for our listeners. We don't have to advocate going vegan or vegetarian, although there are tremendous reasons for doing so, both for human health and for the climate. But this practice of feedlotting the concentrated animal feeding operations, for especially for cows, but also for pigs and chickens, this has a huge impact. I've seen on the climate. I've seen estimates actually that it's close to half of the source of our global warming gases are coming from the commercial meat industry.
It's a huge amount. I don't think it's that much. It's a huge amount.
Yeah, well, I think the other thing you have to consider in this isn't just the quantity of the gases that are released, from agriculture and, and animal husbandry, but that a lot of that is methane. And methane, as a greenhouse gas is, I think in the, over the 20-year time frame or 30-year time frame is 60 times more potent than carbon dioxide. And, even in the 100-year time frame is still several dozen times more potent as a greenhouse gas than CO2. In terms of the volumes of gases, it's not, that's not really, the main question. It's really the impact of the gases that are being emitted. And it's to go back to your question, Harvey, about, the ability for fracking and natural gas to have a positive impact on emissions. One of the things that's consistently left out in those kind of statements is the tremendous leakage of methane, from the natural gas production and transmission side of things. They're looking at only the tailpipe emissions on natural gas fired power plants, as opposed to the entire emissions impact of relying on that fuel source. And I think as we're seeing more and more and more with research that's been coming out over the last year, the leakage of methane, from the natural gas production and transmission industry is tremendous. And there's a question about whether, in building new natural gas-fired power plants and increasing our reliance on natural gas as a fuel source, whether we actually are having a positive impact versus coal. Since coal's primary, greenhouse emission is carbon dioxide, a major portion of the impact of natural gas may actually be from leakages of methane in the production and transmission process.
Yeah, and also, of course, what fracking, which is the primary, method of mining natural gas now, does to the water tables and to the seismic realities of our life. We're talking with Scott Scar of the solar industry and Tim Judson of the Nuclear Information Research Service. We only have 7 minutes left. Very quickly, I was talking about this story in the mail.com from Great Britain, and the big headline is that nuclear power can help fight global warming. But that whole boils down to one sentence at the end of the story, and it says this: nuclear power, citing the IPCC, nuclear power could make an, quote, increasing contribution to low carbon energy supply, unquote, the report finds, but says, quote, operation risks such as disposing of radioactive waste mean there are a, quote, variety of barriers, and among those barriers, of course, were cost, safety, public health, and a few other small details. And I was actually very glad to see that in the IPCC. So they did put out a quotable paragraph, I guess, saying that nukes could help with global warming, but laid out a devastating list of problems with it.
Yeah, that's a very encouraging sign that, that they're taking a serious look at that now. I think that's been missing from a lot of the you know, the official research reports like this in the past. And I think you know, it may be another impact of the tragedy at Fukushima that, you know, that people are starting to look at these issues more seriously. I think, you know, if you look at, I think, you know, in terms of you know, the whole question of how we get to a low carbon future, I think looking at the paths of Germany and Japan at this point, you know, is an interesting contrast. I mean, you know, Germany obviously has, you know, several years ago decided that it was going to phase out its nuclear power plants and do that in concert with its, you know, with its commitments, you know, to reduce carbon emissions. You know, Japan, you know, was heavily committed to nuclear power, and in fact, you know, nuclear seemed to be its primary strategy for, you know, for meeting its Kyoto Treaty obligations. And the fact that that Fukushima happened and the country realized that it cannot afford to have another nuclear accident and shut down all of its nuclear power at once in response to that has forced Japan to basically negate on its Kyoto climate change commitments. And they've seen a dramatic increase in their carbon emissions as a result of that. And I think, you know, one of the things that we need to be looking at seriously is if we're going to meet our climate commitments, that the ability for a single nuclear accident to throw a country off of its entire energy policy in that way has to be seen as one of the problems that nuclear poses for getting to a low carbon economy.
Scott, do you want to jump in on that? Scott Sklar?
Yeah, of course I agree with Tim on this. The real issue for nuclear power is it has very little relevance to the speed and the amount of power we need to address what the IPCC fifth report talks about. We can't wait 10 years for every plant, and we can't put that kind of capital in just one plant. And then if there's a problem, then you have to close the plant for safety. It's just not a rational approach to how we need to address the climate issue. So, it doesn't matter even if you like nuclear power, it's just not relevant to this kind of threat. And so we as a global community have to have technologies that are far more dispersed, that are far more easily, faster to install and utilize and adopt, and in both our homes and our transportation sector and our energy sector. And these blends of high-value energy efficiency and renewable energy are the ones to do that. And nuclear power, as far as I can see, can't really play in all but
Scott, you're doing great. Unfortunately, or fortunately enough, we are hearing from Pete Seeger. Very quickly, Scott Sklar, your website.
www.stellagroupltd.com.
Tim Judson, your website.
Actually, you know what? What I want to do is give a plug to NIRS's new blog, Green World, which is our daily source for news and analysis on nuclear and other sustainable energy issues, and that's www.safeenergy.org.
Okay, you guys have been great. This has been the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show with Scott Sklar and Tim Judson. We'll have to have you guys back welcoming the IPCC report that endorses solar power as the way to climate, to saving our climate. It does not cost the world to save the planet, says the economist who led the IPCC panel. We will be back next week with Michael Marriott from the Nuclear Information Resource Service. Have a great week here at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Thank you, Scott and Tim, and our great crew in New York City. Adios.
Adios.
Thanks, Harvey.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia.
Bit that.